Welcome to Spark Your Fire Podcast. Content discussed on this podcast is general in nature. Please seek specific advice from qualified professionals. Now, let's start with the quote of the week.
You need to be nimble and robust. So you need to be able to take a punch, and you also need to be quick and innovative and doing new things at a high speed. That's the best defense against the future. And you have to always be leaning into the future. If you're leaning away from the future is going to win every time. Never, ever, ever lean away from the future.
G'day, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Spark Your Fire. Excited as always, as we're seeing some positivity on the coronavirus up front, but that's not what we want to talk about today. We're just past the weekend where Sydney auction clearance rates still hovered around 70-odd%, which is fantastic news. But on the other side of things, I guess the Victoria border, or the Victorians, good old Jazz, I'm looking at you right now. What was the clearance rate, mate?
The clearance rate, it was 100%.
Really? So one out of one property?
Yeah, that's how it works. I was actually speaking to a mate of mine who's in real estate. Yeah. And there's not much activity at all, clearly. So.
Well, I'm sure with our guest today, she's also based in Melbourne, so I thought she would be able to give us a more clearer picture. So without any further delay, we are introducing our special guest today, Kate Bakos from Kate Bakos Property. G'day, Kate. How are you?
Hello. It's lovely to be seeing you guys. Even if, you know, it looks like you're on a nice island paradise. We're all trying to live the dream right now, aren't we?
Well, you know what? Even though we are stuck in lockdown, doesn't matter. We can still travel. It's just virtual travel in your dream.
Yeah, that's right.
It's all about, exactly. All about imagination.
Yes.
Well, thanks for jumping on, Kate. I appreciate your time, first of all. You're obviously a very well-known figure in the industry. Do you want to give listeners maybe a quick background on your journey so far?
Yeah, I'd love to. I've been working as a buyer's agent now for the last decade solidly, and it's been a wonderful ride so far. I feel like I'm in the dream job every day, and I'm not being funny about that. I absolutely love what I do, but it did take a long time to find this spot and to find my niche. And I started my professional life as a chemist and worked in corporate and just never really felt that I'd nailed the right career. Obviously, I was, had a lot of study on my plate to get there, and during my honours year I was still analysing auction clearance rates and looking at sales results. So you could argue that the writing was on the wall back then, that property was not going to go away. It would remain a bit of a passion. And I was a property owner at a young age. I had a burning desire to have bricks and mortar. And I was pondering just before I came on the show, what was it about property as an asset class that attracted me? And it's a very hard thing to put my finger on, because I was 20 years old when I was signing my first property contract. And that's, you know, a very young age to want to do something. But I think for me then, it was about independence. It was about a financial future. And I understood the power of time. You know, back then I could see that values were generally consistently going up in the metro areas, and I wanted to make sure that I did something as soon as I could rather than sat back and watch the market outpace me. So that was where it started. But the analysing and paying attention and watching the market, that didn't go away. Mm-hmm. And so that gave rise to wanting to look further into investing. So by this stage, I was a young professional and I was working through borrowing capacity calculators with brokers that probably too generously showed me too much. and I got particularly interested in the idea of building plan and having a portfolio and calculating when I could think about having choice in my professional life, choice to do something else, choice to, you know, not have to necessarily work in corporate for the rest of my years. And I also knew that I was a bit more of a people person. So I had to find my courage and think about making the move into the property industry. And there's no easy pathway into buyer's agency. There's not a university course you can do and then someone that just takes you and gives you a job like you find in other roles. And so I had to make it happen for myself. And I thought a good pathway and a good entry into this space was via a sales agency. So that was what I did. And I was in my 20s. Mm-hmm. And I left a good job. My family thought I was insane, actually. And it was hard. It was much harder than anyone could have prepared me for, but it was also very exciting. And there were elements of it that I felt I was very good at. So that really was the beginning of my journey in the property industry. And that was before being an advocate. I was working in a sales office down here in Sandringham. And I was amongst blokes that had been doing it for decades, and so I was this newbie who was probably a bit more computer savvy, but I hadn't had anyone teach me the ropes. And you know, I would sit there on a Monday and Tuesday night watching them go through their call sheets, ringing back buyers and keeping people on the phone, and there's a lot of it takes a lot of dedication to make it work and to really kickstart your career in property, because the hours are grueling, the knockbacks from people that don't want to hear from you, they're really tough as well. And I learnt to develop a thicker skin and appreciation for what buyers like, what they don't like, how to talk to people and how to get the best out of them in a non-salesy way, because you won't always be able to sell a property to someone who just walks through the door. You deal with a lot of pushback as well. So that was the beginning of it. But, you know, it's a different role to what I do now, and I can chat about how that evolved as well.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So from chemist to property, what was your degree back in university, if we don't mind sharing?
What was it? I did a Bachelor of Science at Monash Uni, and I majored in chemistry and did an honours year after that in the lab. Air-sensitive chemistry was my bag, which meant I couldn't let air come into contact with what I was working with. And so if you ever see those, well, you'll see a lot of it now that COVID is on every second documentary, but when scientists are working within a glass bay and they've got their gloves in the machine, that's one way to do it. Otherwise, you can have all of your experiments running in what we call an argon line. So it's lots of glass tubing and Vaseline sealed connections with all of your flasks, and the line is flushed with argon, so that argon's an inert gas.
Yeah,
and so
it's an inert gas. Yeah.
Yeah, you can add things together without it blowing up. That's the idea.
Wow, actually, funny enough, because I think when you're talking about it, there's still a bit of passion in there too. No. I'm not saying that it's the chemist side of things is completely gone. It's just that obviously you love property more and you enjoy a lot more. Okay, now that's interesting. I was just thinking along the line where the property and chemistry can have some sort of connections, but no, I don't know. I can't think of it.
Patterns, data, to look at something analytically and to recognise whether there is a relationship. Is there a correlation? Is there any connection here with what I'm seeing and what the data is saying? Or is there, you know, a new formula that could apply to a situation like this? Obviously, it won't have the precision that, you know, a laboratory formula would have, but sometimes it might be. I recently had a look at the relationship between villa unit values versus house values and how to determine when a villa unit market is about to have a good run and how to tell when that market has maxed and the values are as high as they're going to get for a little while. And there is a relationship there, and that was kind of fun. It was a
that's
of a
good
moment.
I think you're able to formulate everything or have a systematic way of developing a formula of some sort and apply that into the properties and how you extrapolate and interpret the data and to use that as part of your services to be able to help more people, I guess, to that extent, right?
Thank you. Okay. Yeah, it's a great way of putting it.
And you said you entered the property, your first property, back in the tender age of about 20. Now, I've got two questions there. One is, was there a family influence in terms of getting into property early? No.
No, they thought I was mad. I was pretty driven. And I made a critical mistake, which I've chatted about it just recently, actually. We've had a little bit of a series on our, you know, our favourite old property mistakes. And I signed a contract when I was 20, but it was an off-the-plan townhouse. So I didn't have to settle it when I was 20. And I knew that I had the capacity to do it. Mm. I would hesitate to say I might have chatted to the bank or checked out some online calculators, but going as far as getting a rock solid pre-approval, I probably should have thought that through before I signed that contract. And lucky for me, it was a longer sunset clause and things got changed up. And by the time it settled, I was fine. I had the line in place, but I made a few mistakes, but the critical one was buying off the plan. It's not something that I encourage people to do. And the newness of the dwelling and its rate of depreciation is what can undo your chance of outperformance capital growth. But that's another descriptor. I was working in a Coles delicatessen, but I had regular hours. I had lots of night shift hours and I was permanent part-time. So lucky for me, Westpac came to the party even though I was a student.
Oh, there you go. Yeah,
okay. I had a great LVR though. I'd saved 65 grand and the purchase price was 155. So
wow,
I was in a good position.
Because that leads into the second question that I had originally was, as you can imagine, a lot of first home buyers or people wanting to get a property, the biggest bottleneck is their savings. Mm-hmm. And you were able to get into property at the age of 20. Now, when did you start working and when did you start that savings?
Yeah, I had been saving for a long time. So I grew up down on the peninsula and on the weekends I spent way too much time working in a cafeteria while my mates were all out having fun and making memories. I was working and then I had a night job as well. And the opportunity in the coastal area to earn a lot during that peak season is really high. So I generally had, you know, some corky years for earning income that, you know, outpaced my needs. When I was young, and then when I got to uni, I had a good work ethic. I loved being sociable and going to work and having buddies behind the counter in the deli. So, you know, it was a lifestyle that I was well and truly used to. And so I saved up that money. The 65 wasn't there when I signed the contract, but by the time the contract was fulfilled and it was ready to settle, I was 21, almost 22. So I had a fair bit of forced savings there.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned off the plan, Kate, over there, and it's a very hotly debated topic, whether it's a good investment or not. And this podcast is obviously focused on investors. One, what were your lessons learned from the off the plan purchase that you made? And plus, with your experience in this industry, what are some of the tips? Maybe let's start with that.
Yeah. Great question. I was very, very lucky that the off-the-plan purchase for me went well. And there were a couple of reasons why it was better than it could have been. The first was I bought in Mordialloc, and that was a gorgeous little suburb that was really evolving. It was sort of gentrifying. It had had that rough, culty, beachside, Mordy Boys kind of vibe to it for years prior. And by the time I was focusing on Mordialloc, I was priced out of Brighton, I was priced out of Sandringham, but Mordialloc was beachside and it had the train and the village and things were really starting to take off. And it's gorgeous now. It's got a wonderful vibe and palm trees and, you know, great cafes and pubs. So Mordialloc itself was doing very well. The other thing that helped with that particular purchase was it was a townhouse and it was in a boutique development. So it wasn't, my land to asset ratio was healthier than it would have been if I bought an apartment in the sky, because it was a reasonably large allotment of land that the builder had started to develop and they were doing it in little stages. And my recollection, it was a long time ago, nearly 46 now, but my recollection is that there were about 20 units in the block. And so they were done in clusters of six or seven. I bought into the second cluster and they had a tennis court on the block as well. So it was a nice large piece of land that had, you know, an inherent value. And then given that I was buying 1/20th of that, the land-to-asset ratio was higher than an apartment. So despite the fact that the building would have lost some value very quickly in its early years due to depreciation, losing value, the land appreciation outstripped that. That was because Mordialloc was gentrifying and I had a nice percentage of that entire block of land. So I sold it very quickly afterwards and made a profit. And in fact, when development was nearing completion, the builder contacted me and asked if he could on-sell it to someone for a higher price. So in other words, buy it back and get a better sale price. So I knew then that I hadn't bought a complete dud.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned land to asset ratio over there, right? So obviously
yes.
You are a believer of holding in big chunk of the land. Obviously it's relevant to the suburb. If it's inner suburbs, it will still be smaller, but it's still big for that burb. Fair to say that you try and stick to boutique style with some component of land to the style of purchasing that you guys normally do?
Yeah. What I try to stick to is a land-to-asset ratio that's greater than 60% as a minimum and as close to 90% without it causing an issue, and I'm happy to discuss that. The land-to-asset ratio means the value of the land as a proportion of the sale price. So let's say it's a house and land development and the dwelling itself cost more to build than the land purchase. Well, that land to asset ratio will be less than 50%. And it means that the dwelling's rate of performance will be a sharp decline in value in the early years while its depreciation value is at its highest. And the land component, while it will be appreciating, if it's in the fringe suburbs, it won't be appreciating at the same rate per square metre than what it would be if it was in the inner ring or the middle ring. But if we put that to one side, if the rate of appreciation of the land is not as intense as the rate of depreciation of the dwelling, and if the dwelling is representative of a larger proportion, it's fair to say that asset will go backwards in value for the first few years. It could be 3 years, it could be 7 years. And there's a reason why people who buy into brand new developments and think about selling a few years later often find that their sale price is not as high as their purchase price, and it can be really disappointing for them. But they've enjoyed the spoils of the depreciation tax benefit if it's been an investment.
Mm-hmm. Since you're a beachside girl, do you think that beachside suburbs generally perform a bit better compared to the any other suburbs or the market?
Yeah. If you're looking at a distance from the CBD, that has to be one factor. But you've also got to look at the character and the surrounds and what's on offer. And Peter Kalizos is a great mate of mine and a fellow podcaster. Mm-hmm. And he often talks about distance from the CBD or closeness to the water. And there are other things that people will pay a premium for, proximity to mountains or to particularly special villages. But it's fair to say that coastal, if I was to take Melbourne as a perfect example and go 30 kilometres or 25 kilometres away from the city, I could be very confident that the coastal areas in that radius will outstrip the other areas.
Interesting. And with the COVID situation that we're currently in, right, and you being such active buyer in the market, how do you see things changing down the line, if changing at all?
They will change. Change is inevitable because we've been through something that has really shaken up so many people. There will be people that are positively impacted, dare I say it, whether they're, you know, working in an industry that is buoyed along by this. I know people in the health and the that distribute, you know, cleaning and chemicals that have been in high demand through this. So there's those that will do really well from it. Those that won't really be impacted at all, whose work has continued and the industry will continue to thrive. And then there are those that will have businesses that struggle to get back on their feet or unfortunately won't. And we have to keep in perspective the number of people that are still able to buy and those who are able to spend even more. And if we look at the number of buyers and the number of sellers and consider that supply and demand ratio, that will be what determines our short-term performance down here. And longer term, there'll be other facets that we have to consider, such as, you know, net migration towards or outside of the city. And we're seeing tree change and sea change adoption as a bit of a direct result of COVID. Some of that will be permanent. People will move to the country or to the coast and love it and never regret the move. And then others will find that it isn't as easy for them and it doesn't work as effectively for their lifestyle as they hoped it would. And so that might have been, you know, a false influence or a fad. And we will see some change. We'll see an adoption of different living spaces as a result of this. But the long and short of it is, when I look at supply and demand right now, our supply is very, very low. You said it yourself, and it's true. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of transacting and advertising and marketing outside of the internet. So agents are operating the old-fashioned way, picking up the phone and mm-hmm. chatting to people about what's coming up. We mm-hmm. call those off markets, but the reality is most of them will be pre-markets. They'll be buyers being matched with sellers who were probably going to come onto the market anyway but just didn't want to pay for advertising when there's no point having it. Mm-hmm. So we'll see a lot of activity, I'm predicting, as soon as the barriers open. We'll see transactions. We'll see vendors saying, finally, I can sell my property, because they've got a motivation to sell. They might be wanting to scale down their debt, take advantage of the situation and upgrade their home. They might have been wanting to move away closer to family or whatever it might be, and now they can finally do it, because we've had a pretty stop-start 6 months of being told what we can and can't do, and there'll be a lot of people that, you know, really revel in being able to finally put their plans into place. Now, mm-hmm. what I'm seeing at my coalface is that buyers, I'm sure there are lots of buyers out there saying that they want to sit back and see what happens, but I'm talking to the buyers who don't want to sit back. I'm talking to buyers who are ready to do something and very keen to jump into things as soon as they can. And activity around pre-approvals and lending is at the forefront of their minds at the moment, and it should be. And we're finding that lending delays and processing queues and just all sorts of difficulty with loan assessment has blown out the timeline for a lot of people. So that will remain our challenge. And I think the way that that will shape our market is we'll see a lot of conditional sales taking place as opposed to unconditional auctions. I think there'll be a little bit of a relaxation on vendors and agents' willingness to take conditional offers, because we've got lenders at the moment that, even with the full auction campaign, many of them won't have their customers prepped and purchase ready in time.
Great. For the investors who are actively looking in this market or are, let's say, cashed up, basically looking for the opportunity, no one's got the crystal ball, and a lot of the economists have come out and talked about likes of Chris Joy, the property will go up by 10 to 20%. Likes of Steve Keen will go down by 40%. CBA recently pulled out a report, 10%. They're expecting a drop of a 10%. Where do you, based on your experience and what you're seeing in the markets, and this is not a financial advice, none of that, but where do you, based on your experience and speaking to the network of people, see the market to be in the next 3 to 4 years, especially the Victorian market, but in general as well?
A lot of that will come down to some things that I can't quantify, such as when we will reintroduce overseas migration. And when that happens, obviously that will re-energise the Victorian market for certain, because that was one key driver. We had a lot of new arrivals, and our new arrivals were outstripping other cities. Planning and building developments and approvals will have a huge impact on that. But when I put those two outside of the sphere and I look at interest rates, I personally believe that we're not about to have increases on our interest rates, at least in the short to medium term. And the reason I say that is I can look at bond yields and fixed interest rates and say that there's no indicator right now to suggest that we're about to have an increase on our interest rates. We've, in fact, just had, you know, decrease only a few months ago as a response to COVID. So I think we'll have a low interest rate environment for a long time, and there will be, as we know, a heightened ability to borrow. So borrowing capacity will reflect that, and we'll see that once people are out there buying, the confidence will be palpable, because people, when they're fighting for the home that they want, will usually push to the top of the borrowing capacity. So we will say that if lenders tighten credit, that's an unknown, and we've seen it happen before, that will change that prediction. So I don't want to be bullish on saying we're about to see runaway prices. If we look at the impact of COVID and the effect on buyer sentiment down here, the 10% that was spoken about, we did see, and we saw it very quickly. When coronavirus first broke and they introduced, you know, knocking elbows and social distancing, it was a bit of a shock for us. It was a regime that none of us were used to. And we were then getting reports and seeing the news out of France and out of Italy and Spain. And people were very, very scared. We wondered how we'd weather this storm when it struck our shores and what it would do to our markets. And we had all of the negative media sentiment floating about. And so at that point, and I can tell you the date, the 20th of March, Friday the 20th, was when things started to feel really yuck. We had the announcement of the pandemic on the 13th. I was bidding at auction on the 14th, and the clients even said to me, "But what do you think about this coronavirus? What?" And it was difficult for me because I didn't know anything about coronavirus, but what I did know was if the pandemic was like they were saying it was, we would have some kind of impact on our market. And they were buying a home. And I said, set your price accordingly. If you've got finance in place and this is the home you want and it's long-term, you have to make the decision about your walkaway price. And they did do that. And it passed in, which was interesting because it should have been a vibrant auction. And that was my first hint that confidence was really being rattled. And I negotiated what I think was a great price for them. And then the following weekend, I had buyers starting to drop out. I had clients that had talked about engaging, saying we want to stand back. Agents were starting to talk about vendors that were desperate and were fearful, and their buyers were disappearing. And I started picking up some bargains. I only had a few clients left that actually wanted to buy, but for those people that were sticking with me, we were picking low-hanging fruit and they were bargains. And that those conditions deteriorated until our curve flattened. And then when sentiment started to improve around how Australia was responding to the case numbers, people started coming back. It was very interesting. It was a perfect correlation with the sharpness of the graph. And so I bought, I'd say my sharpest bargains were around that 12% off appraised value as a discount, and then the discounting stopped. And by the time we hit Easter weekend and came out of that, there were no more bargains. Everything was back on to, you know, the appraised prices, which was such a shock for me. But I must say, since then, you'll see opportunities are a little softer than others every now and then, and that's typically a reflection of the vendor's selling conditions and what's motivating them to sell and their fears. But outside of that, I have not seen bargains of that kind of magnitude. And I'm not envisaging that we're about to see 10% falls again. I think we'll see a bit of a market softening if we have a lot of vendors come on for spring, because our spring market will be quite a bit more condensed as a result of having to, you know, we've sat it out. And so if people have 4-week auction campaigns, we won't see the true auction environment kick into gear until October, which means it's a shortened timeframe with more stock. If that's the case, we'll see a slight softening, but I'm not envisaging 10%.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. When you're dealing with your own personal portfolio and when you're dealing with the clients as well, I mean, the experience matters. That's the important thing. How do you decide? And everyone's story is different, but let's talk about average, just a blanket approach maybe to some extent. How do you decide with the clients? I mean, what kind of do you guys do a full-on strategy session where it goes up to what's the end goal or what's the end game here, and how many properties do you need in the portfolio, or not number of properties? I mean, we always get stuck in the bogdown to the number of properties, but more like the what should be the appropriate portfolio size, and how to get there. And because sometimes you get into this, I know I was at one point where I just kept purchasing. I didn't stop, right? As long as banks allowed me. I did that. I'm sure David was in that loop as well, to some extent.
That was when banks were still singing.
Yeah. And I played ball.
And these days, banks are pretty hard anyways. But how do you give guidance to people who are starting their journey and want to build wealth through this channel property?
The first question I ask someone is, why are you here? How can I help you? What are you looking to do? If their motivation is because someone told them it was a good idea, or because their tax accountant said they need to preserve some tax, wrong answer. If they're looking to build wealth long term and they're not looking for a transactional way of doing it, they're happy to be patient, pick the right property and let it do its job, then they're the client for me. And the next question then is about the debt retirement strategy, because you can't build a strategy until you understand which version they'd like. And strategies, there's no right or wrong as long as it's the right one for you. And there are different ways of retiring your debt, and that will determine how, as an advisor, I go about picking the right types of properties for the client. Because if part of their debt retirement strategy is to sell down upon retirement, or to sell some, or to take large debt to their grave and to live off equity, then they're different ways of looking at reaching your lifestyle goals and your retirement goals. My personal debt retirement strategy is to buy a good property and hold it, and not to sell it, to have it organically pay itself down through increasing rent over the years until the property has no debt. And that's easier said than done. It's easier for someone who started very young. It's very hard for someone who starts late. And so if someone is starting late, then buying strong capital growth assets and holding them until they're paid down doesn't make sense, because that person will be working well into the retirement years that they should be enjoying. So there's different ways of looking at debt retirement, but getting it right from a time frame point of view and a cash flow point of view is critical. So the next question I ask is about what do you need to retire on to make you happy? So what's your retirement goal? And they will have potentially super and other asset classes under their belt that will formulate part of their retirement savings plan, or they might not. They might be a bit like me. I don't have shares. My accountant said you need to be diversified, and I said I am. I'm in these states. I've got commercial, I've got resi, I'm diverse.
Different but, property types, villa, apartments, houses.
Yeah, he was very, very uncomfortable with that, but you know, I live and breathe this, and I've got confidence in my strategy, and I've obviously had it signed off and approved from a super point of view, but everyone's a bit different. If someone is saying, I want my property to deliver me this much a year pre or post-tax, then that's easy. Once I've got that metric, often people don't have that in their head though. They say, well, I don't know, I just, you know, want to be comfortable. And so I've then got to work through with them what denotes comfortable, and what other returns will you be enjoying then that we can factor into the mix. And after you've done that, you can then back calculate how much rent you need, so how many properties will that be coming from, and if they need to build, you know, a property portfolio that requires them being reasonably aggressive at the start, then it makes good sense to get your capital growth performer early, because time does all of the hard work there. You can get more rental income centric properties towards the end of your working life, because the pressure on you to continue feeding the negative cash flow on that property is far less, because there's a high chance that it will turn over to cash flow positive in a much smaller space of time, or it might already be close to neutral or right on neutral. So that's how I do it. I have to engineer it based on how much cash flow they've got on hand and what they're prepared to put into their entire property portfolio every month as the shortfall that they're bridging. I also need to allow for buffers. I've got to take into account the advice that they've probably received from a licensed professional like a planner or an accountant, and they will need to identify the things that are important to them that will be coming up as expenses, whether it's school fees, holidays, new house, whatever. Mm-hmm. But once you've fleshed down how much time they've got left to continue servicing the shortfall, and how much they can get their hands on, I need to understand borrowing capacity for this one, and then for the next one, and then for the next one. So that requires using borrowing capacity calculators and being very close to their preferred banker or broker, so that we can get the right answers. And so for someone who doesn't have a lot of cash flow to service a strong shortfall, they might need more properties to deliver stronger rents, and have less cash flow shortfalls. And that's the harder way of doing it. For anyone who's listening to this thinking, give me an example. Steve McKnight was a cash flow investor. He's written books about that. That's one end of the spectrum. I'm not saying it's the easy way, but it's the softer cash flow way. And then you've got all of your capital growth opportunities that everyone talks about. I mean, a big gain over a short period of time is very exciting for anyone, but you have to be prepared for the holding costs, and they can be quite dramatic. And if you think that you can just amass a lot of capital growth properties, you'll reach your borrowing capacity rev limiter unless you're earning megabucks.
Mm-hmm. Oh, especially in current environment where it's possible. That's interesting. We know that you hold commercial in your portfolio. We were discussing that before. With this, with what's happened lately, have your thoughts changed on the commercial real estate and maybe the type of investments that you've been doing in the commercial? And are you relooking your own commercial portfolio because of that and the clients? Or how do you think that space is going to pan out?
Good question. I don't particularly like buying commercial for my clients. My strength and passion is resi, and resi is a really exciting space. It's very dynamic and it's got lots of facets because it's emotional. Commercial's not emotional and it has a place. Have I rethought mine? No, I haven't. But there's lots of different types of commercial property. If I had office space in the city, I'd be rocking in the corner, but I don't. And it's really important to make sure that the commercial property that you do take on, you understand how to buffer your vacancies, how to deal with a client that wants to do a new fit out and ask for 6 months or 12 months of free rent. Commercial can give huge reward, but it also comes with higher risk. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I've got a saying that I think anyone talking about acquiring a commercial property should treat it like they do on the Monopoly board. You have to get some green houses before you go buying the red hotels. It's a bit like that in commercial as well, because it could really tank you if you don't have other property to buffer it. And buffering is really important. I often measure the health of my own portfolio by looking at how many vacancies I've got. And when it's a zero vacancy portfolio for a snapshot in time, you know, you can crack the champagne. That's a good thing. But you've got vacancies to worry about. You've got considerations like land tax. You've got the volatility of rents in varying areas. And if you're in an area that has market volatility or high vacancy rates, you can anticipate that you'll be taking a reduction in rent. And then you've also got to look at the cost of maintenance and the things that are coming up. So making sure that you've got your risk evenly spread and that you've got, you know, some that are much lower risk, they might trickle along and not necessarily go crazy in a capital growth sense, but they're giving you a really nice buffer. As you can imagine, I've been doing this for a long time. So we've got properties in our portfolio that are very cash flow positive, but I've also got some, you know, quirky ones and some expensive ones that are sometimes our headaches.
Interesting. I think Kate as a person is the key to Kate's strategy is the land to asset ratio, the way I got this, and the residential markets. You love residential markets, especially beachside.
I love it all. I mean, I live in Yarraville now, and the inner ring and those, you know, gentrified inner city areas that were once upon a time working class and had industry around them, they're not ugly ducklings anymore. Melbourne's a really vibrant city, and I love the character around our city. It varies so greatly. But I'm also very active in the regions. I think, you know, as Victorians, we're spoilt for variety and choice. Yeah. Just not freedom right now.
Yeah. Are you listening, David? He's in Sydney.
Mate, stage four. Do I have to remind you stage four lockdown is still in place? As much as I love Melbourne City as well, I love the vibe. I'm hoping that obviously all the stage restrictions will go away very, very quickly. And
we just want to show Sydney siders how tough we are. Even in stage four, we are living life.
Oh, we don't have that problem, mate. We've always had, we don't have all that issues. If you go out at the moment, you can go anywhere. Bondi, Manly, you
pick. For now.
Kate, you've came from a bit of a unique background from sales agent to buyer's advocate. Yeah. What triggered that? And so what was the reason?
I found selling got one dimensional, and it didn't mean that there weren't facets of it that I didn't love. I loved the relationship I could build with a vendor who was saying, we've chosen you, we trust you. That's very akin to being a buyer's agent and having a client that, does the same thing and places their trust in you. And, you know, you forge a very tight bond during that time frame. I sometimes say to people, I'll be your new best friend for a while here, because, you know, you're talking to each other almost daily. But the one-dimensional nature of it was that the listing, the pitching, the marketing, the selling, I felt like I could be, you know, a mouse on one of those little rings for the rest of my life. And it wasn't quite what I wanted. I wanted to be in a more advisory-based role. I didn't want to have restrictions around me when I was speaking to people about investing. And as a real estate agent, I might have something that I think is a ripping investment, but my job's just to get it sold and not to pitch its performance to someone, just to tell them what its attributes are. And I just felt like there was a slight mismatch with what I was doing and where my natural skill base sat. And when I had my daughter, well, when I was pregnant, I studied my financial services and got accredited to work as a mortgage broker. And I did that for 4 and a little bit years. And it was great. It was very, very hard. Banks were very difficult to deal with. And it was an apprenticeship that was so valuable. And like an apprentice, I didn't earn very much, because you've really got to be in it for a while if you're a mortgage broker to get your trail going. But what I learned was amazing. And I worked through the GFC. I learned how to deliver bad news. I had to think strategically about everything that wasn't going the client's way. What other options are there? How could I look at this differently? It was an enormous training ground for me, and it taught me about serviceability, deductibility, you know, a lot of the learnings that I got from loan structuring and understanding the tax implication was enormously helpful for what I do today. And obviously looking at understanding what banks like and what banks don't like and what the bank process is, it was great. And I saw a lot of people coming to me with properties that banks didn't like. Obviously they'd bought them and then sourced my support to get the loan together, and I got to ride all of those bumps with them and understand what I wasn't going to buy when I decided to go into buyer's advocacy. So what I really did was put together the three things I loved, analysis and working with buyers and sellers and doing deals and working in the, you know, the agency space, and then understanding cash flow, tax deductibility, loan structuring and the numbers.
So you actually got a combination of skills from jumping from sales agent to broker. So you got that financial background as well to be able to understand how the loans are being structured. And then moving on to the best of both worlds to a degree, buyer's agency and buyer's advocate, to help people from investing, from analysis, from wealth creation perspective.
It's a perfect role for me. It really is. I pinch myself.
That's awesome. Awesome. All right, Jens, over to you.
All right, Kate, you have been doing property for too long. We have been investing for too long.
She doesn't have any other investments apart from property. So I have a feeling that I know how she's going to respond to the question.
It gets boring. Finance gets boring. Let's make it a little bit more interesting. Aliens, believe it or not.
Oh, do I believe in aliens?
Yep.
No.
Yeah. David, you're right. You're in David's camp. He doesn't believe
Told you, mate. Told you.
No. Haven't seen any scientific proof.
Okay, do you believe in God?
It's all evidence.
Do you believe in God?
No.
Oh, that's interesting. Oh, universe is pretty big. You would think there's more out there, isn't it?
The universe is big, and there has to be more. But I think, you know, religion and good core values, that's a great thing. But do I specifically have something I worship? No.
Do you think we'll be branching out to other planets and creating life?
In our lifetime.
But otherwise?
Yeah.
Happening.
I do. Yep, the fact that we can, you know, make it to the moon and get probes to Mars, I think that space travel with, you know, the right budgeting, that's a possibility.
Fair enough. Crypto, fad or a reality?
It's a reality. It's just a dangerous one. Did I want to do it? No. No, I'm the last person to invest in cryptocurrency. I've seen enough evidence of market volatility and runs and sentiment fueled behaviour that is disproportionate to the evidence for me to say it's not an asset class that I want to jump into.
Mm-hmm. That's why it's a dangerous one, I guess. Fair enough. Every guest we had on the show says the same thing. I'm the only crazy one.
I know people that have made a lot of money out of crypto, and it's not to say that it can't be done, but mm-hmm. would I trust myself throwing some valuable capital at it? No. Mm-hmm. But I don't buy shares for the same reason. I'm not good at picking shares.
Fair enough. Do you see AI changing humanity forever, where humans are much more creative, smarter, and is it a threat?
Yeah, it is. It is a dangerous threat. I think that there are roles and tasks that are likely to be less impacted for longer by AI, but I think the rate of growth in that space is really frightening.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Kate, tell you what, really enjoyed the conversation. There's a lot more we can talk about. I'm just looking at the time.
Don't you want to ask for the last three or anything, any other lessons that you'd like to share with our listeners? In particular, our audience are mainly, I guess, someone who's looking at starting out in terms of property, and also those who's, I guess, to a degree, currently maxed out or tapped out. How can they continue to grow? What will be your advice?
Yeah. Wow. I've got two answers there. First up, if you're not maxed out and you're wanting to get the perfect strategy and get it right and time it and finesse it and, reach a scorecard of 100%, don't do that. Just get in now. And I always have the view that, 99% or 97%, even 95%, that's good enough. That's a high score. Mm. So property is like people. Every property is unique. Even two side-by-side brand new one-bedroom units in a tower still have a uniqueness. They're not the exact same product. So property and people are unique. You'll never get a property that scores 100%, but you'll find a good one. So that's my first bit of advice, because the majority of regret that I see in my space is people who put it off and put it off and put it off and then regret it. Then my advice to someone who has hit their rev limiter and they can't do anything, once you get creative and you're looking at different finance models or opportunities, you're taking on more risk and paying more interest, and that in itself can create issues. Sometimes you just have to be patient, let your rents catch up. Obviously, do a quick check with a trusted finance advisor or mortgage broker and find out if you're missing out on an opportunity, or if it might be a result of joint and several borrowings or something that's slowing down your borrowing capacity, or is it your type of job? You need to be in an employment contract as opposed to a casual contract. So there might be some tips there that you can take on board. But otherwise, if you've maxed out your borrowing capacity, it means you've gone aggressive and that you're getting the best capital growth you can find. Enjoy it and let it do its job until you are building your rents to a level that will allow you to borrow again.
Mm-hmm. Great advice.
Great. That's the.
I've loved having a chat with you guys. It's been really fun. I'd like to get any questions, all those political questions at the end that you're not allowed to talk about at the dinner table.
Well, definitely was fun. Kate, we'll bring you back at some point to discuss more about your portfolio and other stories that you have to share, and maybe if your opinion changes on aliens, let us know. We'll just discuss that one topic. But to our listeners, Kate's pretty humble person, her profile's pretty big, check it out, and we'll see you guys next time. Cheers.